Hi.
Morning. May it please the court, my name is Doug Tingvall. I represent the appellant and the plaintiff below, Selig. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes, please.
All right.
This case is before the court on a summary judgment that was granted in favor of the joint venture as against Mr. Selig. So the issue before the court today is just simply whether there are genuine issues of material fact that should have caused the trial court to deny summary judgment in favor of the joint venture. So what I'd like to do first is identify what those issues of fact are that the court should consider, and then I'll expand on each of those.
As you may know, we discussed this case and all the cases on the calendar this morning, yesterday afternoon. Let me direct your attention to something that I'm interested in. One of the arguments made on appeal is that Mr. Selig's status as an employee of the joint venture entitles him to an exemption from the statute that it otherwise governed. Are you familiar with that particular
argument?
Sure. 18.85.1511 is the exemption to which you refer. My first question is, was that argument made below?
The argument, specific argument that the employee exemption applied, it was not made below.
Okay.
The argument next to it.
I understand. You answer my question.
All right.
With respect to the argument not made below, the usual rule is we don't reach those arguments. Why should we reach that argument in this case?
Several reasons, Your Honor. First of all, because the rule is relaxed in the context of summary judgment versus trial, because the record hasn't been fully developed on summary judgment as it would have been at trial, and the consequences and hardships of remanding a case for a new trial are much more burdensome on the parties.
I guess you're not understanding my question. RAP 2.5A gives limited exceptions to considering new arguments on appeal. Direct your answer to RAP 2.5A.
All right. The first answer is that it's discretionary, not mandatory. The word may is used in that rule, and the courts have interpreted, and we cited a case that interprets that rule to be discretionary to the court when the interests of justice are served. So that you look at the underlying purpose of the rule when exercising that discretion. And the underlying purpose of the rule is twofold. Number one, to make sure the record is adequately developed for review on appeal. And secondly, to serve the ends of justice, which in this case means no unfair surprise or prejudice to the opposing party. Why there's no prejudice here to the joint venture is because the exact same facts and evidence that were introduced at the trial court level in the summary judgment context were the same facts that would have been introduced had we raised the argument of the employee exemption. In other words, the employee exemption turns on Mr. Selig's status. What did he do? Was he really an employee or an independent contractor? That issue was discussed below. The argument about whether he was an owner and therefore exempt was discussed below.
Okay.
Well, he was the manager, wasn't he?
No, he was the manager of the joint venture.
Right.
Yeah, and as such,
even though he at some point he was no longer a partner.
He was a partner for 35 years, up
yes.
until 2005. Then he conveyed his interest in the partnership to his children. He was an employee after that. That's our contention.
And you say that because there was this agreement that showed, that was a later agreement that said he continues to be the manager.
Correct.
Well,
let's get back
to my question. With respect to the exemption, 1885-151 sub 1, it says any person who purchases or disposes of property and or a business opportunity for that individual's own account or that of a group of which the person is a member and their employees. Is that the exemption on which you rely here?
Correct.
How does that operate here to allow Mr. Selig to be exempt from the general rule of licensing?
Because for 35 years he was an owner, he was a partner of the joint venture, and then after that he was an employee of the joint venture.
Okay.
The statute was amended in 2010 to address the employee aspect. That wasn't part of the statute before 2010.
So what about services between 05 and 10?
Services between 05 and 10?
He's no longer an owner and the employee exemption isn't extant yet.
It starts to sound like the previous case, whether retroactive change in the statute.
That is the question. What's the answer?
The answer is that the license is an affirmative defense. Lack of a license is an affirmative defense to the claim for compensation. And as an affirmative,
you have to have a license between 05 and 10?
No, he did not have to have a license between 05 and 10 because of the services that he rendered, which is my second prong of the argument.
So that's retroactive, which is what you seem to be saying.
No, I don't think it would apply retroactively. We didn't actually brief that particular issue, but I don't think it would apply retroactively because it seems more substantive than procedural, more than remedial. But the answer to the question about the owner versus employee is that the same statute that the joint venture asserts as a bar to the claim for the commission contains the exemption that's relevant here. And, in fact, it's only about two words away from the word owner. But more importantly, in terms of the purpose of the underlying the rule, is that the same evidence would have been introduced at the trial court level and is before the court now as it would have been had the employee argument been made below. The fallback position is that even if Mr. Selig was an independent contractor instead of an employee and therefore didn't fall within the exemption, the services that he provided were within the property management exemption to the licensing law. There are two types of exemptions. One depends on the status of the person, like employee and owner. That depends on their status. They're categorically exempt if they have that status. There's another exemption, a different section of the statute, that says if your activities are limited to property management, identified as 1 through 5, then you're exempt from the licensing law to enable...
Let me ask you another question, and time is short here. One of the exhibits to Mr. Selig's declaration below lists what I take to be his calculation of what he's owed. It's a $300,000 amount. You know generally what I'm talking
yes.
about. And it appears to track from years 2005 to 2010, compensation that he received, which I take it is reflected in parentheses, and compensation, additional compensation, which he claims to be due. Is that the sense of that?
No, his claim is based on a promise by Goldschmidt, who was the attorney for the majority of the partners, that he would receive a bonus, as they called it, of 6% of the purchase price or sales price.
Well, that's the sales, but I understand that he's also asking for compensation as an employee that really doesn't have anything to do with sales.
Yes, that's correct. And
what's the measure of that additional compensation?
Value of the service.
And what dollar amount is that?
That would be the amount that he alleged in his declaration.
The $300,000.
Yes.
So,
in addition to the 6%.
So this exhibit does, in fact, represent the measure of what he's claiming as an employee. Do I understand that correctly?
Yes. For the purpose of the record before this court, that's correct. There's more to it than that, but that's, we believe, enough to get by summary judgment.
And just a final question. With respect to this particular exhibit, there are items that are reflected in parentheses, which usually means a deduction. Does that mean that he, in fact, acknowledges that he received that compensation?
I believe so, Your Honor.
So for all these years, he's been receiving compensation at a certain level, but now wants to have additional employee compensation.
He did receive a certain level. What happened is he received money as money was available. And under the FHA guidelines that govern this Section 8 project, he couldn't receive money if it wasn't available. So there were many years he didn't receive much of anything, and there were other years he did receive compensation.
You.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Jordan Hallstrom, and I represent 308 4th Avenue South, the joint venture. We are here today on Mr. Selig's three assigned heirs, and as we've touched on, one of the heirs that he assigns is his only properly pled cause of action, breach of contract for management services for real property known as the Downtowner Apartments.
Well, let's talk about what I'm interested in, and that is the applicability of the exemption from licensing. Counsel has conceded the argument was not made below and argues that we should reach it nonetheless under RAP 2.5A. What's your response to that?
My response, Your Honor, is that 2.5A was designed for the specific reason to bar this type of appeal where there was no mention in the record whatsoever of this error. As you're well aware, many appeals contain numerous voluminous pages of clerk's papers, and if we allow appellants to recreate the record and decide on new errors that are not in those clerk's papers, we're essentially opening the door for any sort of appellate issue.
Okay, you've given the answer I anticipated. Now, with respect to the exemption itself, if we chose to exercise our discretion and reach the issue, why does this particular claim of exemption either create a genuine issue of material fact or not?
Your Honor, it does not create a genuine issue of material fact. We are talking about, as you mentioned earlier, the exemption of subpart 1 to RCW 18.85151, and that exemption is limited to any person who purchases or disposes of property. This is not a cause of action for disposing or purchasing a property. As alleged in his complaint, his sole cause of action, Mr. Selig alleges a breach of contract for management services of the property. By the plain language in this statute, that is not purchasing or disposing of property.
I think their argument is that the joint venture disposed of property, and so under this exemption, its employee, which in this situation is arguably Mr. Selig, also qualifies for the licensing. I think that's the argument that's being made.
Your Honor, there's two separate claims here, two assignments of error. There is the disposing of the property, which we can reach secondarily, which involves the statute of frauds, and Mr. Selig has absolutely no writing to evidence any sort of percent commission on the disposal of property. That is what he would allege would fall within exemption subpart 8. The second part of that is the management of property, for which Mr. Selig asserts that exemption subpart 13 applies. However, this exemption, when read in its explicit form, it only applies if the person is limited in property management to any of the following activities. The activities specifically delineated involve clerical activities such as delivering leases, showing an apartment, those sort of things that occur in the office. The joint venture concedes that Mr. Selig likely did entertain and do some of these non-exempt or some of these exempt activities. The problem Mr. Selig has is that the statute for exemption specifically requires his duties to be limited in the property management to those activities.
That is which section exactly?
Subpart 13, Your Honor.
I see, okay.
What is very critical here is that this is something that was brought specifically on summary judgment, that Mr. Selig engaged in brokerage services that required a license.
Can I ask you a question here? Could you tell me which year of the statute you're relying on? Are you relying on the current version?
Yes, Your Honor.
Then why does your brief not set forth the current version? Your brief sets forth a version which is not the current version of 331. However, on page 9 of your brief, you set forth a version of 331, which ends, without first alleging and proving the plaintiff was duly licensed at the time of services for which he seeks compensation. But the actual present version of 331 says something different, which does not refer to services. And I'm trying to find it here. It says, without alleging and proving that the plaintiff was a duly licensed real estate broker before the time of offering or to perform any real estate transaction or procuring any promise or contract for the payment of compensation for any contemplated real estate transaction. It refers to real estate transaction, not real estate brokerage services.
I apologize, Your Honor. I'm attempting to locate that.
You happen to have your brief there?
I do. Are you referring to our appellate brief?
Yes, and the same statute was quoted in your brief below, but in your appellate brief, it's at the bottom of page 9.
And just to clarify.
So your argument proceeds on the basis, this is the actual bar, that no suit or action shall be brought. Mm-hmm. So your argument is that it can't be brought if the person engaged in real estate brokerage services, but the actual statute, in effect, now doesn't say that.
The current statute, RCW 1885331,
does not say a real estate brokerage services, and in fact, it does not say services.
Correct, Your Honor. It says no suit or action shall be brought for the collection of compensation as a real estate broker.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Selig was.
Without alleging and proving.
That the plaintiff was a duly licensed real estate broker.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. And if I'm understanding your question correctly, Your Honor, Mr. Selig was a real estate broker. His activities that he engaged in, including negotiating rents, collecting rents, holding himself out as the broker, management and the downtown apartments.
But the problem is that I'm having is that I don't understand why you would give us a statute that is not in effect and base your argument on that statute as if it contained the words real estate brokerage services when it doesn't.
Your Honor, what I recall is that RCW 1885 also contains a definition section. I believe it's in .0010 that contains brokerage
services.
Well, but
now you're making an argument that it isn't a statute. You offered us in your brief a statute that doesn't exist or is obsolete. And your argument is based on it. And now you're trying to say, well, but it's okay because something else means something. And I just don't see how we can proceed to honor your argument if it isn't based on a statute that is currently in effect and without any explanation as to why you would do that.
Your Honor, my explanation is that the statute cited requires bars collection for compensation as a real estate broker. A real estate broker engages in real estate brokerage services. That would be my explanation to that as a broker.
Arguing this statute bars the collection of the management services or the bonus?
I would argue that it bars the collection of the management services, but it would also bar the statute of frauds would bar the collection of a commission as well.
As Judge Becker read earlier, this says before the time of offering to perform any real estate transaction or procuring any promise or contract for the payment of compensation for the contemplated real estate transaction. All of the services that Mr. Seelig performed except for procuring the buyer for the building would seem to be outside of that description. Would you agree?
I would disagree, Your Honor, because it specifically talks about what compensation as a real estate broker and the definition of real estate broker and brokerage services.
But it doesn't say anything a real estate broker does. It says before the time of offering to perform any real estate transaction. That's something less than all of the activities a real estate broker can do. Or procure a promise or contract for the payment of compensation for a contemplated real estate transaction. Again, that's a smaller universe than all of the activities that are described as being real estate broker activities in the statute you've asked us to look at today.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's Judge Becker's concern, is that this statute seems to require the allegation and proof of a license for a narrower set of circumstances than we're presented with in this case.
And, Your Honor, the explanation I would give to that is this is, the statute's been amended in different versions, but it has been in existence for about 100 years.
In different forms.
Okay.
Don't we have to apply the statute? I mean, you want us to apply the statute as currently in existence, I take it.
Yes, Your Honor.
But you quoted us a different statute, which, what you're basically asking us to do is to say that, if I can find it here, that no suit or action shall be brought for the collection of compensation as a property manager without alleging or proving that the plaintiff was a real estate broker. So basically you're saying that anybody who sets themselves up as a property manager has to prove that they're a real estate broker.
Yes, Your Honor, and that is...
Do you think let's say that somebody owns a small apartment building and they live someplace else and they hire a retired person to... post ads on Craigslist and solicit for new tenants. Is that person doesn't have a right to get paid?
Your Honor, under the law, no, he does not. He is required to have a real estate broker's license. And the case law and the legislator has made clear the purpose is to protect the public. What you are asking or the scenario that you give allows essentially anyone to bypass that. And
well, are you saying that for the 35 years that Mr. Seelig did get paid, he wasn't entitled to?
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct.
Are you asking to have it disgorged?
No, Your Honor. The case law is clear that contracts like this are illegal and null and void. Mr. Seelig did receive substantial compensation over the years.
Unfairly, according to you.
Yes, but, Your Honor, illegal contract, and that means that the joint venture also is barred from seeking that compensation back because the case law is clear that an illegal contract leaves the parties where they are. So Mr. Seelig is barred from seeking compensation, as is the joint venture barred from recouping any compensation under the illegal contract.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Upon additional reflection, I'd like to address Judge Leach's question about the retroactive application of the employee exemption and say that it presents an issue of fact for trial as to what portion of the services were compensation during the period when it might not have been exempt as an employee. He was an owner until 2005. He was an employee from 2005 until late 2011. And if during that time he wasn't entitled to compensation because the employee exemption wasn't enacted until 2010, then that's an issue of fact for the court, for the trial court, and that's part of why summary judgment shouldn't have been granted. Addressing briefly the statute of frauds argument, the statute of frauds argument requires two elements to be established before it's a bar to a claim, and it likewise can only be asserted as a shield and not a sword. The two elements that have to be shown is that the person acted as a real estate broker, which of course begs the question, material fact, all over that issue, and then secondly, that a person was hired to engage in the sale of the property. Mr. Civic wasn't engaged or hired to sell the property. He was the property manager. He was the joint venture manager for 40 years. This was incidental, and he didn't have to procure the buyer or negotiate the sale or be the procuring cause, as real estate brokers typically do to earn a commission. Instead, he was promised a bonus to compensate for undercompensation that occurred over a 40-year period. That was how it was couched.
It sounds like you're primarily concerned with getting him the 6% bonus than you are with getting him the $300,000 in property management service.
I'm concerned with both, but of course it's a bigger ticket item with the 6%.
I would say.
Yeah. And so initially, and that's an issue of fact, too. What were the terms of the promise that was made by Goldschmidt? Mr. Selig alleged in his declaration that Goldschmidt promised to pay him 6% of the sales price. But there were some preliminary discussions about 80-20, where he would get 20% of any surplus over $11.5 million, and the partners would get the 80%. Mr. Goldschmidt said, I don't think I could sell that to the other partners, so let's go with a straight 6%. But it was never reduced to writing. And Mr. Selig's former attorney wrote a letter to Mr. Goldschmidt and said, you promised me on numerous occasions, and same with David Klorenblau, who was also involved in the management of the joint venture, you've promised on numerous occasions to reduce this to writing, you've not done it, and we offered that for the purpose of showing silence, admission by silence. That is, the joint venture objects on hearsay to Mr. Selig's attorney's letter, which, of course, in and of itself would be hearsay if it was used for the matter to prove the truth of the matter asserted. Pardon me?
Is it a sufficient writing in any event?
No.
If it was admissible?
No, it's not signed. And so if a writing is required at all, that wouldn't be sufficient. But a writing is only required if it's covered by statute of frauds. So we get back to that issue of fact, is was Selig acting as a real estate broker? And he couldn't have been if he was exempt. And the exemption is categorical. That is, if a person's an owner, as he was for 35 years, or an employee, then he's exempt. Now, the joint venture makes the argument he was an independent contractor, not an employee. Well, that's an issue of fact, too.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.